concentration. Concentration and calm. There's a calm is required. It's a level of where everything kind of just goes still, you know. And for me, it was the gun went. Okay, so you get out on the track and you're ready yourself, and then you're standing there, and then you hear the starter call the runners to their blocks, and then they get up in the set. You hear the gun go. That is at that moment, all the butterflies, all the nerves, everything is gone. And then just a complete still environment. You're still, the crowd is quiet. Everybody is just there. Everything went gray. I did not see people. I didn't hear people. I was just running almost like in this tunnel where just wind was going by my ears. I could feel nothing. This mindset where you hear and feel nothing. Until he extended his hand, I didn't even see him. And then he sticks that hand back there. I see it. And I extended, and it was almost, like I said, it was almost like the baton was on a string. It was in the air. Rooney just wrapped his hand around it, and I knew at that point.
Welcome to the Evolution of Leaders podcast. My name is Darwin Lee, and I am a speaker and coach. On this podcast, I'm interested in exploring the traits, habits, or behaviors that allow elite performers to break through their barriers, through their stories, and in their own words. On this episode, I interview Glenn Roy Gilbert. He's a multiple world champion in the 4x100 meter relay, Olympic gold medalist at the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. He's in the Olympic Hall of Fame and the Canada Sports Hall of Fame. He's now the head coach of Athletics Canada. Canada loves Glenn Roy Gilbert. He's got his own street named after him. Glenn Roy's just a wealth of knowledge. He talks about how he entered the flow state and how he got there in 1996 during his gold medal run. During his career, He took risks, and some of those didn't pan out, and yet some of those paid off handsomely, and those were excellent insights. He talks about his experiences in 1996 and listened to how he nearly walked away incredibly. It's incredible when you think about how it was a career-defining opportunity and moment for him that led to his 4x100 meter relay gold, and just nearly missing that opportunity was amazing, but more so how he came back from the thing that was holding him back and seized that opportunity. Two Olympic programs in Canada have been identified as making significant gains and becoming, you know, world powers on the world stage. And one of them is Athletics Canada. And Glenn Roy has been a huge part of that. And he's got amazing insights. And you'll understand when you listen to the interview how he handles large egos and personalities and becomes such an effective head coach. I hope you enjoy this interview. Glenn Roy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Darwin. Appreciate it.
So Glenn Roy, as we start off, I'm wondering if you can just kind of describe your own career in your own words.
Yeah, you know, my career, I think in sport, in athletics has been a bit of a up and down at times, some success, some disappointments. I think it's been a mixed bag overall as an athlete as a former athlete. So reflecting on it, I can certainly, there are a lot of lessons learned more from the school of hard knocks more than anything, just simply because there was no script beforehand, just like I don't think there are any scripts beforehand for anybody, but I had to kind of learn how to kind of navigate the sport, navigate, you know, success and disappointment. And sometimes it seemed like the disappointment outweighed the success at times. But okay. But yeah, it was quite a roller coaster.
So you're mentioning disappointment here. So what are some of the things, and how do you learn from some of those disappointments?
You know what, for me, and it has always been where, if you fail, you have to, especially if it's something you want to do, you have to learn to get back up. And if you want it bad enough, I just feel that you will deal and take those lumps, because again, you're looking at down the road, you're looking at that prize that you're working towards. And it's like we use the word perseverance and commitment and all those things. I think we use them fairly loosely, but I think when an athlete or an individual in anything that you're doing, it doesn't just have to do with sports. If you're focused on the end goal, which could just be For us, it was medals. For us, it was running fast times, those type of things. But it could be anything for an individual. Then you recognize that you're going to hit some bumps in the road. So you're almost expecting to do that. You just have to prepare yourself for it and continue to keep your focus on what you're going after.
And do you find it hard to maintain that balance? I imagine there were times you might have thought about not continuing on, but and yet you're keeping your eye on the prize. How did you maintain that balance?
You know what? I had many moments when I just thought I wasn't, I couldn't do it. I was just too much, and there are too many things. There are too many, catastrophic things that would get in the way. And I'll give you a quick story, if you don't mind. And right around my 1991, when I lost my youngest brother, who drowned, it was that very time. I think we were coming up on the Canadian Championships for the selection for the World Championships in Tokyo. And everything I did, I just could not get up. I couldn't get going. I thought, okay, well, you know what? We'll mourn. We'll be together, and then I'll just get right back at it, and I'll be able to perform the way I had leading up to that point. And nothing. It just couldn't. I couldn't do anything. I didn't think that I would be able to kind of continue in the sport just because of the loss. But I'll tell you, you find focus, you find passion in trying to deal with the loss of like a family member. In my case, I just willed myself. I just thought, okay, I know that my brother would want me to continue. I know he'd want to see me on the podium at a world or an Olympic Games down the road. So then I used those disappointments and those losses to fuel the energy that was going to take me the rest of the way in the sport.
When you thanks so much for sharing that and condolences on that. But when you say you used it to fuel you going forward, what did that mean in sort of the day to day or week to week, how that might have looked at the time?
Yeah, I mean, any time you did not want to go out and train, any time you didn't want to eat properly, any time you didn't want to read the materials that would help you deal in difficult situations, you remembered that, you know, there are other people that are relying on you. There are other people that you know would be proud of your success when they were here, they thought that you were the absolute pinnacle of anything that they wanted to see achieved. So you just use those things on a daily basis, and then it simply becomes part of who you are. And you just don't know how to quit. You just keep pushing. And it's finding the fuel, I guess, finding that the passion and the desire to be the very best you can be.
So Glenroy, I understand there's an interesting moment with Atlanta when you had some interesting experiences. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about what happened.
Well, in 1996, in 1995 in the fall, I had worked really, really hard to get ready. I had won medals in the relay. I wanted to make the Olympic final in Atlanta. Winning a medal, I knew that was going to be a long shot in the 100 meters. But to make the final, I thought it was something I was capable of doing. I trained all year for it. Got to Atlanta. Things leading up to that, I was married. My marriage fell apart. I went to the trials in Montreal. I was low. I was the lowest I'd ever been. I relied on my teammates, Donovan. Donovan was huge in this moment. He really helped keep me on track, pick me up during the trials. I was able to finish third in 100, make the 100 meter squad for the Olympics. When I got to the Olympic Games, again, the focus continued, and that was going to be to make it to the final. That was it. Went through the heats, that was okay. Went through the quarterfinal and finished, I want to say I was maybe fifth in the quarterfinal. I was in a race there with Otto Bolden and did not advance. I remember crossing the finish line and running into, there was a barrier at the end of the finish straight, and I just held on to the barrier, and I was crushed more than anything in my life. I've never felt anything like it. I took my spikes off, And I was standing when I took them off. So I left them right there and I walked out. I walked out of the stadium and I went up the warm-up track, took my stuff, got back to our accommodations, and I was packing my bags to go. I was done. I had suffered the last disappointment in athletics that I was going to deal with. I was done. Again, things conspiring in my mind to keep me from my goal. I was just finished. And I remember going in there and I was talking to our coach at the time, Dan Path, who said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm leaving. And he's like, well, what about the relay in a week? I said, I'm not running the relay. I didn't come here to run the relay. I came here to run 100 and a relay, but I'm done. And so he said, okay, well, before you leave, I just want you to read this. And so he handed me the book, and I don't remember the name of the author, but I'll tell you, the book was termed Out of the Darkness into the Light, right? And it took me maybe about 5 or 6 hours. I started reading it, and from the first page, I think it was like maybe 200 pages, to the very end, that book reshaped my focus. In that moment, it was gone, and I recognized that people suffer disappointments all the time. It happens. It's part of life. It's something that you're going to have to deal with. This won't be the last one. And how do you cope? How do you pick the pieces up and move on? And 2 days later, I was sitting on the steps of our accommodations waiting for the guys to go to the track. They were blown away. They didn't realize that I was still there because I spent like 2 days in my room just grieving over my my disappointment in the Open 100. But I was able to change the script and go back out there. And just imagine the outcome being what it is. It would have never happened had I decided to leave that day in Atlanta.
What is it that you hung on to that allowed you to change that script?
Well, I thought about like, okay, I was crushed. I was like, you know, I cried. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. Life at the time was the darkest it's ever been. Like dark. It was probably as dark as when I lost my brother. I didn't know how I was going to get out of it. But the story that I read in the book talked about, you know, a man that the disappointment of his life and how he was able to try to come out of that and be even better than what he was beforehand, just understanding that these are things that happen and the way you react to them is really the key. Sometimes you need to take a little bit of time to kind of recalibrate yourself, but you've got to get back, as they say, you've got to get back on that horse. You've got to get back out there and you've got to do it. And this was my way of saying, okay, I'm going to stay. I'm going to go. I believe that there's something bigger here. And when we won, that was the one thing I tell people as a testimony to stick-to-itiveness. I talk to them about, yeah, I almost missed this moment. I almost missed this moment because of suffering a loss beforehand, which you know, you have to be able, and I tell my kids here all the time, you have to have a short memory. You can't carry things around because they're going to have an impact on what you're capable of doing down the road. I've recognized that I can fail, things fail, but then what you're getting ready for once they fall, that's why I talk about that ebb and flow, is something greater than what it was before. So, you know, you don't make the final, you're crushed, only to a week later getting on top of the Olympic podium, not winning a medal, because I think winning a medal would not have been the same thing, but you now triumph on top of the podium. Something that's never been done before in Canada and never been done again in the US.
And that drove you to one of the big highlights in your career is winning the gold in the 4x100 relay. And as we set up, we'll play it in just a moment here, but just to set it up, I mean, there had to be immense pressure and although Canada had done very well, you're not expected to win. And the crowd is pro
Hostile.
Pro not Canada. Pro USA and who ended up winning the silver. So you're in the ready room, and I understand there's some trash talk that happens there. Mm-hmm. So leading into it, when it's kind of a high pressure moment, and there's a lot of talk where there's maybe some egos involved, and it's mental warfare. How do you stay focused, how do you handle that type of situation?
Well, a lot of times in situations like that, especially while we were at the Olympic Games, we knew that our performance a year before at the World Championships, a lot of people didn't see it as a legitimate performance, because the U.S., we didn't beat a real team. We are world champions, but again, you're not world champions unless you beat the U.S. in that competition. So the way most people saw it was, well, Canada won, but the U.S. wasn't in the race. So in order for you to really get your crown and glory, you have to beat the United States of America. And that's, and they're in our sport and in relay running, they were the best at the time. So, you know, for us, it was really, we knew what we needed to do. We were struggling through the first two rounds in terms of being able to close the gap on the field. So when we got into that final preparation room, there was a lot, like you said, there was a lot of trash talking, a lot of comments from various teams about what was going to happen when we got out on the track. But we, number one, we knew that we could win. We knew that we could win. We knew it wouldn't be easy, but you know, winning an Olympic gold medal at the Olympic Games, obviously it's not going to be an easy task. So a lot of it was just making sure that you remember what it is you needed to do there. You know, for me, I'll give you a perfect example. I control two zones. So I take the baton from Robert and I pass to Bruni. So those are the two aspects that I have to control. And for me, remembering that there are six guys or five relying on me to do my job, and I can't let them down. This is one of those situations where there is no fail. You cannot fail. You cannot fail, and this has got to be the best race of your life, because there's no guarantees we get back here. So all of these things are in your head. All of these things are swirling around, and you're trying everything in your power to really stay calm. If you need to trash talk to do that, some people need to do that, others don't. I certainly never really felt I needed to do that. You can strut around a bit, like a bit like a peacock, more of an intimidation thing without the words. But everyone has a different way of dealing with stress and with those type of situations. And plus, we recognize that, look, we won the world championships. This is our competition to lose. We've listened for a week. We've listened to a lot of trash talking against Canadian sprinters, against the fact that, you know, Donovan won the 100, you name it. So we listened to a lot of this, but we also were quietly confident that we were going to win this race.
Does it get physical in the ready room at all?
It can. It certainly can. I think when you deal with different egos and different individuals that are hot tempered, I think they certainly can get a little shovey, pushy, you know, that type of stuff. You can get to the point where guys are taking swings, because again, you're on the edge. You're on like that razor's edge.
And you can't go yet.
Of emotion, and you just need, you're pent up. They're keeping it. It's like corralling these animals in this small space, and you're trying everything that you can in your power to free up. So that's the energy that you're just trying to get out there. Right. So, and you know, in most cases in the call room, they recognize that they can't keep you in there very long. You never know what might transpire.
And there's a great moment between, there's a couple great moments with the arms going up in the air. Mm-hmm. And this is the race here. It's on Robert Hesmy's blast off page, which is great.
Yeah, doing a great job.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I play the race here, and it's going to be Robert, as you say, handing off to you. Mm-hmm. and then you handing off to Bruni. And so, right. When the race goes, you're watching him come down. What's going through your mind?
You know what? I'm just thinking, okay, just get me the stick. Get me the stick. I'm ready to go. And I usually kneel on the track. And once I have the baton in this race, I'm gone. Like, I just, this is the moment. This is the time that I was looking for. I don't hear or see anything until Bruni extends his hand. And then the baton, like I said, I've told most people the baton felt like it floated in the air for a second before Bruni just grabbed it in midair. So, I mean, as you can see, this was a race that I think surprised the U.S. It surprised us a little bit as well. I certainly speak for myself when I say that it was a bit of a surprise because we didn't expect to be that far gone in the race.
Yeah. And there's a great moment when Robert, when he hands it off to you and he, right here, and he extends,
yeah,
he sticks his hand into the air, which is a great moment. Yeah. And, man, it's, there's just so many iconic kind of moments in that race. And it's, you know, one of the most watched races in the world, for sure. And you know, when you look back at this, yeah, with the benefit of hindsight, what kind of feelings and what thoughts run through your mind?
You know what, I'll tell you, even 24 years later, anytime I watch it, and I don't watch it often, but whenever I do, I get goosebumps because it takes me right back to that moment. I can kind of play back the warm up. I can play back the walk through the call room. I can play back the walk from the call room onto the track. I can play back, you know, stripping down and standing on the track for about 45 minutes before the race actually went. I can play it all back like it happened yesterday, simply because when the race did start and I saw Robert come off the corner, I was like, I just left. I mean, the mark was there. The mark was solid. I took off. And when I had my arm fully extended and I still didn't have the stick, I knew that at any moment I was going to get that baton. And once I did, I got the baton in full stride, which is rare. You're typically either slow. You try not to be too fast because if you are, you're out of the box, right? So, it was almost a perfect pass, fully extended. Both Robert and myself was extended. The same thing with Bruni and I, and you could see that on the track. It just, you know, it is the perfect way you want to run a race at the Olympic Games, leaving everything on the track.
And I wanted to share something with you as well. And this is myself talking with Bruni, okay, about the same race here. And
I'm going to pass it to Donovan Bailey.
And here it comes. As I pass and it, then there it is. And then,
yeah.
To your
yeah. Yeah. Of course.
You ran a great leg, but one of the very interesting things is in your leg, Glenn Moraes, it seems like you went into what's called the zone. And there's a fascinating quote from kickasscanadians.ca, and this is how it goes. It was gray, just gray. There was nothing. I could see nothing. And the only time I came to was when I was making the pass. I started making the pass, and all of a sudden I could see Bruni's hand. I could see his hand shaking. So there's something about like excellent and being in the zone and whatever this flow state is. And I'm wondering if you can take us through that and what that was like and how a person might get there.
Yeah, I think, you know what, I think you get there through concentration and calm. There's a calm is required. It's a level of where everything kind of just goes still, you know. And for me, it was the gun went. Okay, so you get out on the track and you're ready yourself, and then you're standing there, and then you hear the starter call the runners to their blocks, and then they get up in the set. You hear the gun go. That is at that moment, all the butterflies, all the nerves, everything is gone. And then just a complete still environment. You're still, the crowd is quiet, everybody is just there. And it was only when Robert, basically when I took off running and I felt the baton in the palm of my hand, everything went gray. I did not see people. I didn't hear people. I was just running almost like in this tunnel where just wind was going by my ears. I could feel nothing. And it was only when I ran into the zone and I saw, I called for a stick. And I know Bruni is one of the best sprinters in the world, like short sprinters, meaning, I mean, he covers 100 very well, obviously one of the best, but also a 60 meters. So here's a guy that can accelerate better than most, far better than a lot of people. So I have a job of coming into him recognizing that I'm running into one of the best sprinters in the world. So for me, I have to make sure that I close the gap and I close it quickly. And there is no room for a misstep. But I knew that before even coming in here. So that's all part of kind of going into this this mindset where you hear and feel nothing. Until he extended his hand, I didn't even see him. And then he sticks that hand back there. I see it and I extend it. And it was almost, like I said, it was almost like the baton was on a string. It was in the air. Bruni just wrapped his hand around it. And I knew at that point that we had won that race. Now, you know that, but you have to wait for the officials to verify it for you. Because there's a lot of things that could go wrong in a relay race. And I've certainly been there where I've celebrated a bit too soon. But I think overall it was probably, I would say I have never, my legs, my body, nothing has ever moved like that on me in all my years. And we've had some good relay races, but that was one that just, and I mean, and rightfully so, it was the Olympic Games. That's where these things need to happen, where everything, all your training, everything that you've done over the years, it all got to come to bear on that specific day. That's what makes it so incredible, because it's finite. It's either you hit it or you miss it. And again, it really sells the idea of high performance or performance on demand type approach.
That's incredible. And even now I can feel that you can feel it just seeing that. Now you're in the, and congratulations on making Olympic team is one thing, but being a gold medalist, that's incredible. Now you're in the Canada Sports Hall of Fame. Congratulations on that as well. There's a statement there, that's kind of associated with you in the Canada Sports Hall of Fame, which might say more about you than any other I've seen. And it's quite incredible, because this is what it says. Gilbert brought the principle of team values into the egomaniacal world of men's sprinting and was the soothing counterpart to the fiery Bailey and Surin. And so you went along with, Robert Esme, Bruni Surin, Donovan Bailey, as well as Carlton. And Surin and Bailey, you're all world-class sprinters. Surin and Bailey are two of the top, the greatest sprinters, at the very top. And yet you are the glue. And so it says something about your ability to be able to manage conflict and preserve the essence of the team. And that's incredible. And I'm wondering if you can take us through what did you do that enabled you to be able to become that glue, to overcome the personalities and the conflict, to bring everyone together?
Well, it's a good question, right? Because I don't know the transformation to that role and how I got there. I can't really even remember the actual steps in getting there. I certainly remember being there, and I know what I was thinking about. I mean, you have to understand, to some extent, you have to understand when you're trying to work with a group of athletes, and everyone cannot be pulling at the same time. Everyone cannot be going against each other all the time. There has to be, and I recognized a long time ago that there has to be some compromise made. There has to be, especially when you're looking at a relay team, you've got six guys. How do you come down to four? And then once you have that four, how do you work with it? Everyone wants to run the anchor leg. Everyone wants to be the one carrying the stick over the finish line. Everyone wants the glory of saying that I ran this on this leg. That is always the case. Okay, so I think when I was young and growing up, I played soccer for a little while, and I was the worst teammate, the absolute worst. I was very competitive, but I also did not want to rely on anyone. I went to track and field because I wanted to be an individual. I didn't believe in team. I didn't think that a team environment would work for me, because I wanted to be that individual athlete out there, relying on myself and not relying on others. So the transformation to becoming not only a team player, but also one that worked really hard to keep our group together by way of recognizing the individuals and what it is those individuals may need from me, from others, in order to get them from the warm-up track to the stadium to compete together. And then after we were done, we would celebrate. Or if it was disappointment, we would disperse, and then we would come back together later. It's just, in my mind, it was always around finding the commonalities between the individuals and how can I meet them in the middle. And if I have to be the conduit between different relationships, then that's what I'm going to do. Because I always, like, again, at the onset of this conversation, I talked about that goal, right? That goal that you set for yourself that you want to achieve, mm-hmm. and how do you achieve it? And if it means that you have to find creative ways to work together with individuals that have egos, and rightfully so, we are in an ego-driven sport, and the event of relay running is no different. Then you have to find creative ways to work with each and every individual. Because if you can connect with them individually, then you find nuances to bring them together as a team. Again, you're not going to hold them there long, but you can hold them there long enough to get the job done.
So what were, if I can ask this then, what were some of the connecting factors to Bruni and to Donovan specifically?
Well, okay, I'll speak to Donovan. Donovan obviously was, and I can speak to Bruni as well, and Robert, any one of the guys, because what I did was I almost made it a bit of a case study in trying to understand them, and their triggers, or what I thought were their triggers. It may not have been, but it worked in the moment.
It seemed like it did. Absolutely, so, it seemed like it.
I mean, Donovan obviously was, the Olympic champion. He was a world champion the year before. So right away, there's this notion that we need Donovan on the track to succeed. But I and it's true, we did need him there. But he recognized too that as a group, this was another way for him to get another gold medal. So it wasn't simply, well, I'll run the relay and that'll be the end of it. He was running it because he wanted to win as well, right? And so we needed to rally around him, especially on the anchor leg, making sure that he was confident, he felt good around what he needed to do. We know that once we had the stick in his hand, there wasn't going to be an issue. So you work around building confidence and letting him know, hey, look, we need you. We can't succeed without you, or we can't win without you. We can win a medal, but we cannot win without you. So really conveying the need to, once you're done your individual, and this starts like way in advance. It doesn't just happen right at the games, right? So once you're done your individual event, you know, you get a couple of days to relax, but then we need you there. We need you at practice. These are conversations that we would have and clearly building that rapport. The same thing with a guy like Bruni. Like Bruni, we knew there was a bit of disappointment there with him in the individual 100 because he should have been on the podium. I mean, he's that good. When that didn't happen, it was important now to really illustrate to Bruni that, look, we need the same individual that would have been in the final of the 100. We need you on that relay leg and finding it wasn't about convincing him, because he knew what was on the line here. And I think that at the end of the day, it's just letting him know that, hey, if we don't have you there, if we don't have both you guys, then we can't get the job done. It's as simple as that. If we want to win, we need everyone's buy-in, and we need to get along. We need to hold it together, you know. So these are the kind of things that you But you just, you play to their strengths. So you play to areas where you may feel there may be a bit of, there's a bit of struggle. There's a bit of, you know, I don't know, or, you know, you've got to recognize those things coming or see where that might happen and kind of head it off at the path before it kind of manifests itself in the individual or on the team and then causes bigger problems.
And that's very insightful and that's a total kudos to kind of finding the individual things and then tying those together, because it does seem like you were the glue. Now, over time, then you're shifting from this athlete to a coach, which itself is a sizable shift. But then you're going from working with the, you know, doing some of the relay work, and you've gone from coach to head coach now, someone who perhaps not only coaches athletes, but coaches coaches. And so that's another big step up. And so I'm wondering, you know, how you made that adaptation, and for someone stepping into a new role where they're maybe taking more responsibility in leadership, or what approach, you know, might a person take? What advice would you give to that person to succeed that you found has worked for you?
Well, when I started, coaching, I got first of all, you learn, I had a great mentor in Alec Gardner, the former head coach, actually two head coaches removed from Athletics Canada. And, he was a huge part of me getting into coaching, recognizing in me that, the ability to coach. And so when Alec approached me about it, I worked for CBC Radio for a year beforehand. And then I got into coaching, and really as an apprentice, just following other coaches around, Molly Killingbeck, some of our national team coaches at the time. And the thing that I recognize more and more, it's the same, it really stems from also being an athlete, is understanding that you have to have a certain degree of empathy and recognize that this is not anything that people do, it just takes them time to kind of get their footing in it. So you have to have some patience. You have to be willing to lead and trust and give them leeway to even make some mistakes if they have to make it, but recognizing that you were there once yourself, right? And how, like, again, this comes back to just being empathetic of people that are learning something new. You talk about coaching coaches or working with coaches. I use the experiences that I've gone through to try to make them better coaches, and also illustrating to them that, look, making mistakes and not having all the right answers all the time is part of it's human nature, number one, and it's part of growing as a coach. But if you cannot recognize the athletes, because for me, a lot of this is about the athletes, and we work for them, and how do we address them? How do we get them better? Recognizing all the challenges that they have to deal with in order to perform on demand. And by understanding that, I think you become a better coach. You become a better leader, is understanding the challenges that people have to go through in order to reach that state where they're confident in the role and in the job that they're doing. It's going to require your patience. It's going to require your commitment to them, your ability to also to teach them, to guide them, to have patience with them, and to be empathetic to the fact that somebody is learning something new. They didn't just jump into it and all of a sudden you're a perfect coach, or you're a perfect leader. You need time to grow, and you need space, and you need to be that person that can act as a sounding board to help that person and direct them. Because that's basically what happened to me. I didn't arrive on the scene and all of a sudden I was a great coach, or I knew everything about athletics. There was a period of growth, and there were people that I could go to, and people helped me problem solve and all kinds of different things. And I've had made a lot of mistakes with the athletes as well, to where now, and who's to say I won't make them in the future? I certainly recognize that we're always learning.
Sadie Smith, a sprinter whom you worked with, says this about you. Glenroy's really good at explaining what you need as an athlete, not just the training, but also the mentality. So he's the perfect coach any athlete wants. And so I'll ask you this, and for the next couple of minutes here, I'll ask you to suspend the Canadian humility here. Mm-hmm. and I'll ask you, what does the perfect coach do, Glenroy?
Well, number one, the perfect coach challenges the athletes. I think you have to challenge. You have to draw them a picture. They have to understand that what this sport is about, or whatever the sport that they're doing, what it is about. Like not the warm and fuzzy parts. You know, recognizing that there's winners and there are those that don't win. And you have to say what happens at various phases in that sport, so people understand that, you know, we have a job to do as athlete and coach. And if you're in the, what are you in the sport for? Are you in the sport to have a good time, just to make friends? Are you in the sport to win medals? And it's funny that you talk about Shay. It's a very, very talented sprinter, but more importantly, a very smart young man. He really has a good understanding, a good head on his shoulder about a lot of things. And, you know, I've always challenged athletes about those type of things and say, here's what the tapestry of our sport looks like. There's that 5% at the very top that are winning medals, that are making Olympic finals, and then there's the rest of the field. Where do you want to play? Where do you want to be in that spectrum? And so really understanding what is needed and getting our athletes to focus on exactly that. Because we are in a business of delivering high performance results. Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? What is required? And drawing that picture and making sure that in my role as a coach, my job is, I'm not a recreational coach, I'm a high performance coach. So I need to work with athletes that want to win medals. I want to be in the top eight, that want to be at the very top in the sport. So the athletes that I coach, I explain to them as to what is needed. I explain that there's a certain timeline that is required here and how we address that timeline. And you have to get on board with this, or you don't, and you choose a different path. And there's no real hard feelings either way. Clearly, I want you to go the way of the medals, because I think at the end of the day, drawing them a picture of what it feels like to achieve at the highest level versus not achieving. There's a feeling that you have. There's a euphoric, a satisfaction of hitting your goals when you do perform on demand. When you don't, then there's a lot of time you spent kind of soul searching as to, well, what did I do wrong? How did this not happen? All these type of things. I'd rather be on the other side of that, right?
There's a number of improvements that Athletics Canada has made, and a lot of it during your tenure. And there's Anne Merklinger with on the podium, whom we've spoken to as well. She specifically noted how swimming and athletics had made significant strides in recent times. What are some of the things do you think that Athletics Canada did that really set it apart and set the bar really for a very high level of excellence?
You know what? I'll tell you, I think with Athletics Canada, what has happened, and Athletics Canada, again, coming down from on the podium and the expectation for Canadian athletes to expect to perform, expect to win. I mean, in the past, we were more, and this just dates myself as to how long I've been involved in sport in Canada. We were just happy to be there. You made the Olympics. Good for you. Everybody was excited. You got you got to run in your heats. Maybe you get to a quarterfinal, maybe a semifinal, and you were happy and you were gone. And that was your life. That was a career, a well-fought, well-deserved career. That shift in Canadian sport came when athletes and coaches started to believe, well, simply put, why not us? If everyone else in the world can win medals, small countries, large countries, people are performing and winning medals, why not Canadians? Why are we satisfied with simply just being a spectator in the sport? You know, why not strive to win? And I think with athletics is, and you saw this kind of evolution over the years with the funding and the programs came the expectation. So if someone is going to give you a certain amount of money to run your programs, they're going to expect something back from that. And what is that? That is performance on demand at the world and at the Olympic level, right? So you saw athletes recognizing that, hey, look, we're having programs, we're able to get to the best training venues, we're able to get to competitions, we're able to perform with some of the best countries in the world. Why can't we then win medals at the Olympics and the World Championships? If we're able to see these athletes throughout the year and compete against them throughout the year, why not? Can't we perform when we have to meet them at the championship meet at the end of every 2 or 4 years, right? So I think that with athletics, you saw in 2013 us winning a bunch of medals. You saw us winning medals in 2016 at the Olympic Games, 2015 at the and China, I believe, in Beijing, when we won. I want to say we won 8 medals. You know, there's a shift in thinking that, and then it's almost like it's a cascading effect, right? When you see athletes out there performing, then it's contagious. She's like, well, hang on a minute, if she can do it or if he can do it, why not me as part of your team? So everyone gets behind this idea that we can win medals. We're Canadians, yeah, but we can win medals. We can compete with the best teams in the world. And that is where our program is now, is where athletes and coaches expect to win medals. They're not going there anymore just to be a participant, but rather to be an active participant, meaning we're going to perform on demand and we're going to win medals and we're going to finish, we're going to make finals, we're going to be in the top eight and those type of things.
Wow, that's amazing. It speaks to like a really shift, not only, you know, in from the top, but that something that filters down right into absolutely. The entire organization, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, there's one of the more difficult moments for Athletics Canada was at the 2012 London Olympics, when Canada for a moment appeared to have won the bronze, but then was disqualified on account of a lane violation. And it was very difficult, but one could see that the team, they didn't hide from the media. They did the media calls. They handled it with a lot of grace, and you could see the disappointment on their faces. But even in such a crushing kind of moment and environment, how did you lead in such a difficult moment, you know, from your vantage point?
Well, you know, we had prepared for those. I'll tell you, I wear it. I wear it like the athletes. The only difference with me is that I want it so bad for them. That's probably my weakness as a coach, is like I'm too invested in the outcome for them. And the outcome has to be a positive one. There's no options for a disappointment, especially at the Olympic Games. So you do everything in the lead up to make sure that they're prepared. I did not see this one coming. I got to tell you, we did a lot of work with the group. We had, I think, 9 sprinters. So we could run and pit them against each other, really to prepare them for the relay race in London. And we, like I said, we started at the beginning of this is not something that started at the beginning. It started years before, but it culminated with London, right? So you could see where there's a lot of, it's funny because anytime I'm asked about London, it's one of those coaching moments that probably has resonated the most with me, because the disappointment really cut me personally very deep, because of what I saw the athletes, their commitment, their focus, their training, everything that they did to lead up to that moment was excellent. And we talked about relay running in the past. It's difficult sometimes to get everybody on the same page, but it took a lot and we got them there. So I most people didn't expect them to be, in the final, didn't expect them to be running for a medal. However, I did, because I knew what we had and I knew what everybody else didn't think we had, which is great, because at the end of the day, they don't know what I know. And so I wanted these guys to go out there and shock the world. They would shock themselves in the process, because they thought they could be in the final for sure. I don't think they really believed that they can win a medal until after the heats. After the heats, they realized, because they went in ranked third. So all of a sudden now we had complete buy-in. I mean, you have buy-in, but there's a little holdout here or there. But by the time they ran the heats, they knew. They came back to the village and they knew they can go out there and they can win a medal the next day. But again, you've got to keep everything down. You've got to keep the emotions in check and all those kind of things. So coaching the team during that time was, it was awesome, because you start with wanting to, you have this big tapestry as to what you're trying to build. And then you narrow it right down to an Olympic final and the result of that final. And we did, I thought myself and our biomechanist and our coaches did an excellent job in preparing this team and preparing them for a medal. Because what I wanted to do is I wanted the naysayers, because there were a lot of those people that didn't think that these guys could do it. I wanted them to see what can happen when you bring athletes and coaches together that believe in a common, and they set a common goal and they systematically attack that goal. Just chip away at it until you get there. And for like 7 minutes, whatever it was it took for that final result to come up on the screen, for that moment, I was like, here it is. This is a perfect end to a track up to this point. This is a perfect end, because nobody saw them coming. And then, of course, we saw what happened with the lane violation. God,
when I'm doing the background and I'm looking at the articles and I watch that live, it's easy to relive it and bring back. But do you now, then, going forward, Do you take positives, if I can say it that way, and teaching moments?
Going absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what that showed me was that if you get your guys together enough times and you're able to work with them in a systematic way, but that's, again, that was the lesson, was X number of competitions, X number of training camps, a number of guys, how many guys are those? Guys who can run the straightaway, guys who can run the bend. They don't necessarily have to be the very best sprinters in the world. They have to be good, but they don't have to be the best. And then you drill them and you teach them about relay running, about taking and passing a baton. Once you learn that and they can get through the 20-meter zone faster than another team, the fact that they may not be faster individually is made up through the zone. And so we've learned that, okay, Canada, in the past, we've had good sprinters. We haven't had like 6 world-class sprinters, but we've had good sprinters. So we take our good sprinters and we put them, or our great sprinters, and we put them with some good sprinters, and we can make something that can win medals at the World and at the Olympic Games.
Okay. And you've noted in 1996, you know, when you talk about high level sprinters, you know, so Carlton gets hurt, mm-hmm. And you, Bruni, Cerin, and Donovan Bailey, you're looking for someone obviously to fill that role, and you saw something. You all three saw something about Robert Esme, and your phrase was interesting. You say he showed hunger. And now you've coached a number of very, very successful athletes, Andre Grasse, Aaron Brown. That's just two names out of many, many top-ranked athletes in Canada now. There's something, it seems, visible, like palpable, that kind of oozes out of the very best. And I'm wondering kind of what separates the top athletes apart and what that hunger looks like.
Well, we're working with... In a relay environment with guys like Andre and guys like Aaron, like Gavin Smalley, some of these guys, and you know the hunger is really one of, you know, we're representing Canada, we're representing ourselves, we want to show the world that we're among the best. The history of relay running in Canada is clear. I mean, we've won medals at the world and the Olympic level for years. These guys are a continuation of that very success. So you have to honor that. You have to honor that, and you have to kind of put your own marking on that kind of that tapestry of results over the years. So looking at guys like Aaron and Andre as examples, these are world-class sprinters in their own right, the very same way that Donovan and Bruni were. So They want to win first and foremost in their individual event. And then just like the guys did in the relay would then come on board in a 4x1. And now it's a team effort. And Canada as a whole recognizes team. I feel they recognize team before they recognize the individual. They like to see it's a hockey team, you know, it's a football team. It's rather to see the team perform. So Canada's men's or women's relay teams are where Canadians can get on board and say, you know, here's our team, rather than, well, the individual is clearly going after the individual pursuit. Whereas when you're a part of a team, you're performing, and I guess in ways people see it as you're representing Canada more so than when you're doing it as an individual, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what you see in these guys is just the need to, number one, they need to perform because they want to show the world that they're among the best. They want to show the world that they're talented. They want to show the world that, you know what, I came here to perform. I didn't come here for any other reason. I came here to win. So all these guys, they start by wanting to make the final. And once they're in the final, they throw everything at getting on that podium. And you see that personality because they're very structured, they're very focused. And you see it starting early in the years of competition.
And you posted this up on your Instagram a ways back, and from this list, some of the things that I'm picking up on really are kind of the attitude, mm-hmm. being coachable, and things like that, and communication, relationships is also mm-hmm. very important. And I guess we saw that in the way that you connected with Bruni and with Donovan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I think communication is usually the toughest one, because I feel anyway, simply because you have to find the optimal way to communicate with an individual. And because I can communicate one way with you doesn't mean I can communicate that same way with someone else. So that's constantly evolving. It's constantly changing. But there's some basic, I think, ground rules, if you will, in communication, in that you have to you have to appeal to the person's to their passion, the things that they're interested in, and not dismiss those things, right? So you have to find a communication key in how you're going to deal with each individual. And I think being honest and forthright with people is key, because I think a lot of times if you're just doing something, you have to show legitimacy in your relationship. Like there's this, you know, I care about you outside of what I need you to do here. This is bigger. It's bigger than just this moment, because down the road, win or lose, however this washes out, we're still going to be friends. We're going to remember this day. Yeah, it may be. We hope it's going to be a great memory, but it may not be. But even in the face of not having a good memory, there's still things that you can take from that relationship and say, hey, you know what, this was good. So I think communication is a tough one, but you have to have some interest in the person in order to develop a style to communicate with them.
You know, on the theme of working with athletes as well, now you have a very interesting excerpt from the book, The Champion's Mind, in which you were featured. And you state there that you're always finding ways to stay hungry and focused. I draw on that lesson now as a coach by encouraging my athletes to take the time to recover, not just physically, but also mentally. So at first glance, it seems like they're different kind of ideas, staying hungry and focused versus ensuring that you get your recovery. So I wanted to ask what that dynamic looks to you.
Well, staying hungry and focused is really there are two different dynamics, but they're really the same, because in order to stay hungry and focused, you have to be rested, you have to take time to recover, but you recover both physically and mentally. Because you're recovering, it doesn't mean that you're not focused and hungry anymore. Like, everyone needs to recognize you can't stay focused and hungry year in and year out. There has to be a downtime. But you, in that downtime, you're not forgetting the fact that here is my goal. Here is what I'm focused on. I can be focused on something and not be thinking about it every single day and every single moment. It's there, and you know it's set in stone. That's what I'm going after. And that's what I mean in terms of the two. You need to recover. You need to take time to focus on recovery, because if you don't recover and you stay focused on anything too long, what ends up happening is you end up burning yourself out. And if you burn yourself out, then that goal that you've set for yourself gets further and further away. Mm-hmm. So there is a bit of a, it's not a contradiction, because I think they're one in the same, because mm-hmm. in order to shoot for the star and to get to that place, you have to have had some recovery patterns. It's like if you watch a training plan, right? In any training methodology, there's that super compensation. So you work hard and then you allow the body to recover so then it can perform even better, right? And that's that super compensation in your training. It's the same mentality when you think about your mind and your focus. You focus on something, but then you've got to recover a bit in order to shoot and get that curve even higher up.
That's really fascinating. And I suppose in a way, there's a lesson here, you know, in the way that your brother in that situation kind of drove you, and you use that as fuel going forward. But then later in your career, you got a little bit tired of track, and it became kind of weighed on you a little bit, it seems like. And you tried bobsled, mm-hmm. and it was a calculated risk, and it seemed like it really paid off, and it really helped your explosion, and thereafter led to some personal bests in your 100 meter times. I've spoken to a number of high level athletes, and you certainly agree, and they agree with you, that perseverance, discipline, and work ethic are very important. But you have a fascinating and a very different perspective as well. And that is that you state that the number one factor is luck. And I'm wondering if you can take us through that, because that's a very interesting take on things.
Yeah. You know, I think luck is an interesting thing. And I mean, it's a rabbit hole. You can get down there pretty deep, but I'll be honest. And I do believe that. I think that, you know, cause I've seen athletes, and I've seen athletes that are talented. I've seen athletes that are not so talented, but they've got great work ethic. But there's a degree of luck and timing, and all those things have to be kind of aligned. And you don't know where that's going to be. Like you mentioned bobsled. Well, I went off to bobsleigh as part of Canada's two and four man bobsleigh for the 1994 Olympic Games in Lillehammer. And the Olympic Games were 2 years before that, I think in Aberville, if I'm not mistaken, where Chris Laurie was fourth by like a millisecond, just off a third, a bronze medal. So he came out, got a bunch of, you know, these sprinters, and he had a great, great, great squad, a great crew, very strong, fast guys that was going to take him to that millisecond more to get that medal, right? 2 years later, and we ended up finishing, I want to say maybe 11th and 14th. I mean, what changed? In 2 years, what changed? Well, you know, again, I think that's where, you know, in that moment, he was off by a millisecond. Then you get a better sled, you do more runs, you get some great athletes behind that sled, and then you finish 11th and 14th. So I think there's a degree of luck in everything that we do, and I'm not saying you can be unlucky, because I think that in that case we had everything and it didn't work out. So there's a bit of luck not being on our side. And then of course you had us at the Olympic Games in 1996, and unfortunately Carlton ran two rounds of that race and then got sustained an injury. And then Robert, sitting on the sideline, who would never have run, ends up being interjected into that race and was the very linchpin that we needed to win gold. Because do I think that we would have won if Robert wasn't in there? I don't think so. I think he I don't think so. I honestly don't. And that's not taking anything away from Carlton. It's not taking anything away because, again, Carlton ran two rounds beforehand.
Yeah.
This is just a guy with fresh legs coming in and infusing a level of enthusiasm, a level of speed, and matching the Americans, which is really what we were looking for. I mean, we all ran well. We all ran better than we ran the two rounds before. But the guy who led off was really the guy that the fuse. He lit the fuse. That was the guy that started it. Because without that, I don't think we would have won.
Wow. Okay.
The other guys may disagree with me, but that's fine. I don't really care. It's been 24 years.
It's your mic right now, darn it.
That's right. That's right.
Do you think luck then, you know, the famous quote with luck meeting, you know, opportunity, it sounds like that's a little bit what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying, because I don't think that you can benefit from luck if you're not fit, if you're not in the right place. And that was the illustration that I was giving. Like, you really have to be, you need luck, but you also have to be prepared to take full advantage of luck when it does come. Right. So you can say, well, you know, okay, well, I'm not going to do anything. But if things strike, goes in your direction, then what? And if you're not prepared for it, then you still don't take advantage of it. Right. So that is exactly what I'm talking about.
Fascinating. As a coach now with a lot of high level athletes and you're dealing with egos, but in a different way because you're a head coach now, how do you now handle the tensions that may come with a lot of, you know, confident, large ego testosterone type environments and turn that into like a winning team now as a coach?
Well, you know, most of our team, like everyone on, like in terms of the entire Canadian team athletics, right? They, to some extent, they know a little bit about my background. Some of them weren't even born when we were doing our thing. But I think the benefit of experience at the highest level helps me with credibility, helps me with understanding and the empathy involved in understanding what those athletes and coaches are dealing with. So it allows me to address and face the moment differently. So if I'm talking to a guy like Andre, or I'm talking to a guy like Mohamed, or some of our top athletes, I recognize the things that they need to do as individuals. It's really putting yourself in the place of the athlete. And what would you do if you were in this position? So I try, whenever I'm having conversation with people, I try to put my own emotion. How would I feel if I was in this position? How would I deal with this situation? And so I think when you can do that, then you have a way better understanding of what that person is dealing with. And it allows you now to find ways to compromise. I'm all about compromising. There are certain things that you have to be hard on, but you can't come in there as it's my way or the highway mentality in sport, because the sport is about the athletes. So if we don't have the athletes, it's not going to matter. So if the athletes say, well, no, I'm not going to do it. Well, you don't have the athlete in the sport, you don't have a job. So you have to find a balance. You have to find a way. And again, it all comes back to relationships and building the relationship with the athletes. And I think when they know that you have their best interest at heart, then they're more willing to work with you. They're still going to want everything they want. That's never going to change. So you have to find a way to get to somehow find a, to put a wedge in that, to say, okay, well, if you have all of this, can I get this? It's a negotiation and it's constant. It doesn't change. And finding creative ways to meet those negotiations, recognizing first and foremost that without the athletes, we don't have sport. And so we can't come in there and kick the door in and say, and this is generally amateur sport anyway. So it's not like they're these high paid millionaire athletes that are contractually obligated to do certain things. We're asking athletes to do a lot of things, and we're not giving them a whole lot to do it. So the relationship is really that much more important in finding ways to communicate.
So the closing question here, you're quoted as saying, I see sports as a metaphor for life. And what is it about you? What is it about sports that in your words has made you a better, more selfless person?
You know what? The lessons learned through sports, lessons of like love, of failure, of disappointment, of things going really well, like, so the highs and lows, the ebb and flow of sport is the same ebb and flow of life. You have moments when things are not great, you're a bit low, but then there are those euphoric moments, and it's the same thing in sport. Sport gives you those big euphoric curves, but also gives you the huge letdowns when things don't go your way or don't go the way you expected them to go. And that is the metaphor to life, because life is exactly like that. You'll have a period or a season where things are going really well, and then you'll have times when they're not going so well. And so what you do in both those situations is going to be key for your survival as an individual through the many challenges and successes in your life.
Glenn Wright was one of my favorite interviews, getting into the zone, just being relaxed and being ready. And then again, I can't get over just nearly quitting and then coming back into that run and entering the flow state, that mythical zone, and running, in his words, the fastest head body had ever moved, and how he describes being in a tunnel and the wind rushing by his ears. Incredible. In my opinion, his greatest skill is, it seems to be, relating to people, not just as athletes, but as the people behind the athlete, and how he truly values them as teammates, as his team members, and as athletes that are training with him. And Glenn Wright broke through so many barriers to get to where he is. And coaching helps us to recognize and get over some of these things. I am a speaker and coach on these topics, and I would love to hear from you. I'm at evolutionofleaders.com. I do this for love, don't charge anything. So really would appreciate it if you liked, subscribed, and shared. Thank you so much. Make sure you get 1% better. Have a great day.